United Lutheran Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast, conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Good day. Welcome to the Seminary Explores. My guest today is Dr. Scott Hancock, who is the Associate Professor of History and Africana Studies at Gettysburg College. Welcome to the Seminary Explores.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. And I'm just going to jump in right away because I know you are a historian. And I wanted to ask you, what drew you to history, the study of history?
Well, actually, I wish I could say it was some great intellectual quest, but my previous career was working in group homes with teenage boys. I did that for 14 years and found that it wasn't enough to pay the bills as much as I like doing it. So
okay.
Just needed a career, something that I could make a living at, and grew up liking history. I grew up a military kid, so reading about military history and thought I had some ability to teach, and applied to grad school, had a very good advisor who helped steer me in the direction that would make me marketable when I got out.
That always helps.
Yeah, he helped a lot. And I relish the intellectual challenge and inquiry of the job and love what I do. But, you know, I can't say that I initially got into it because I had, you know, some great altruistic vision. It was more I needed to make a living,
and this was it. But also share in that living with others. Yeah. You know, that's important too.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and you're here at Gettysburg. You're at Gettysburg College here in town. And how do you find Gettysburg as a place for doing history?
Yeah, it's fascinating. So my first teaching job was actually in Alabama, University of North Alabama, which was a good place to be. But for various reasons, Gettysburg College made a good offer and drew me here. And there's definitely a uniqueness to being here because of the history of the town and the battle and the Civil War. And actually, when I first came to Gettysburg, when I did the interviews here, I told them I wasn't interested in doing Civil War history. They had very accomplished Civil War historians here, so there was no need for me to. But I have found since I've been here, it's you get pulled in that direction, at least to things that are related somehow tangentially to the Civil War, which has been good. And it definitely informs your research. And part of it is the opportunity to do stuff like this, right, this podcast. There's a constant draw to do public history, to make history relatable and relevant to current issues, to the broader public.
And when you say, could you expand on that public history?
Well, so there's academic history, right? The kind of stuff that you write for journals or academic presses. And the reality is most of what academics publish in journals, although it's important because it informs larger discussions and ways to think about the past and the present. But most academics, we know that, you know, at most maybe a few hundred people are going to read your work, unless you're one of those very few who publish something that gets widely read.
Right, because very often we're focused on the very narrow or particular.
Yeah, and all that stuff matters because it builds the bigger picture.
Right.
But public history is much more about interacting with tourists, with school kids, with whomever has any kind of interest in history. And I like to tell people, history, I think, is the most important academic discipline.
I think we'd have a conference on that, debating that issue.
Yeah, I have no doubt other scholars would disagree, but of course they would be wrong. But because I argue that history explains the present. You know, history explains how we got to where we are today, and it relates to the West African, the Ghanaian concept of Sankofa. You know that. In order to understand where you are now and to have effective solutions for the present and moving forward, you have to understand the past. You have to know where you came from and how you got to where you are.
Very much so. It seems to me, or my observation from looking at media, listening to the media, that very often we want to forget the past or don't know a lot about the past.
Yeah,
And so so I guess there is work for the historian.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I certainly hope so.
Right. Sure. Yeah. As you, your appointment is in history and Africana studies. Mm-hmm. What are your areas of research in terms of the African American experience?
My primary research initially, before I came here in the first few years I was here, was understanding how African Americans interacted with the law and the legal system before the Civil War, so colonial revolutionary America into the early 19th century. And mostly I was looking at ordinary folks, not so much the like Supreme Court cases, although occasionally those, but just how ordinary people like you and I would have interacted with the justice of the peace or ordinances and statutes and things like that. And thinking about, so what did that look like, and how accessible was the law to people who were in many ways were on the bottom of the political, cultural, and economic ladder?
My perception is that it wasn't very accessible.
Well, and that's what I think was surprising. Because I was looking in the North. So granted, in the South for enslaved people, it was not nearly as accessible. Although there's been some good scholarly work examining how even for free people of color in the South and even for enslaved people, sometimes they understood how the law worked more than we might suspect. Now, in the North, the legal system in many ways was somewhat accessible, was more accessible because just of the peace courts, it was, you know, it was just around the corner and anybody could go at any, right. almost any time of day. And because that kind of lower court was accessible to a broader range of people, I actually found that black folks used those kind of courts a good bit in some northern cities.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then there were limits to that.
For sure.
But yeah, that was in some ways it makes sense that they used it because it was one of the few avenues they had. So, I mean, you get this ideology in the United States, right, that the law is king and that
right.
the law is supposed to be accessible to the common person, even though that wasn't the reality. But on some level, because that's the ideology, there's a need to make sure that there's some truth to that. So black folks often found that was one of the few avenues they had where they could actually get some leverage. And so you find sometimes poor black people taking, you know, middle class white merchant to court and over some minor matter and having some success in that court. I mean, I'm not saying that was the norm, but
right,
it wasn't,
exactly.
It wasn't that rare.
Right, so, but that it did take place.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And as I said, there are limits to that. You know, the higher up in the court system you go, the less likely you are to be successful. And just like today, you know, the more money and influence you have, the more likely you are to get favorable treatment in the law.
Right. Huh. Okay. Well, one of the we ran into each other, or I encountered you recently at a Rhodes Scholar presentation here in Gettysburg, and the focus of that conversation with the participants was with the Underground Railroad.
Yeah.
And Gettysburg is known for the Civil War, but it's also known as a place where some slaves came on the road to freedom. How did your interest in the Underground Railroad take place?
Yeah, well, that's another kind of non-altruistic story. And so I came to Gettysburg in 2001. So after I'd been here a few years, there was a symposium at Dickinson College, and they were doing stuff on the Underground Railroad in South Central PA.
Right.
And so they called me and they asked me if I would come do a paper. And I still today think, I suspect that what they were thinking, oh, there's this black guy, gets recology, he does African-American history, he must do the Underground Railroad.
Right.
You know, I said, it's not my area of research. I don't really know much about other than, you know, kind of broad generalities
exactly.
about the actual work mechanics of the Underground Railroad. And I'm not an expert on South Central PA. And they said, well, we'll give you $200. And I said, okay. All right, I'll come up with something.
Follow the money.
Yeah, right, yeah. But it actually led to a really interesting work because I think, in part because I realized I wasn't an expert. And there are other people who had done a lot more work on exactly what the mechanics of the Underground Railroad were, you know, how people contacted other people, how escaping slaves made contact with black allies in small towns, like black communities like Gettysburg, and how they made contact with the white allies and all that kind of stuff. So I've wanted to think about it differently. And so what I did was thought about, okay, so you have this border, the Mason-Dixon line.
Right.
That's not an actual physical border, right? There's no wall there. So what gives that border force is law, right? The law says that on one side of this boundary, slavery is legal. On the other side, although in Pennsylvania, you know, the legality of slavery changed over time, but it signified freedom north of the boundary and slavery south of the boundary. And then also looked at geography, and so thinking about how the mountains and valleys transgress that border. So when escaping slaves are following the mountains and valleys, that's what's leading them north, right? And so right. no legal line drawn across those mountains can stop people. You need something to enforce it.
Right.
The enforcement is the law and the mechanisms of the law. So what I started to realize in looking at some of the newspaper accounts and debates of the law and legal case at the time was you get these very different perceptions of what the North signifies in people's minds and what the South signifies. And part of that meaning of what the North means and the South means is because of what these black men and women who are trying to escape are doing, right? And because they keep violating that line. The South slave owners are saying the North needs to reinforce that line. They need to enforce the law. The North, a lot of northern states like Pennsylvania, are saying, well, you know, we're not going to force people to catch slaves and bring them back. That just makes southern slaveholders more and more angry. So the perception of these two sections of the countries as having some fundamental difference begins to grow wider and wider. And eventually that leads to the Civil War. And so I'm not saying that this is the only thing that caused the Civil War,
right.
But I think what has been underappreciated was the fact that the most powerless people in the country, slaves, are having a disproportionate effect on the politics and culture and legal understandings of the country. And so in some ways I've argued that escaping slaves were a key part of what caused the Civil War.
Oh, now that's an interesting piece because you don't think of those people escaping being able to overturn or to cause a change in the culture.
Yeah, not that kind of change. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
And it's not just cultural change, right? It's culture, it's legal, it's economic, it's political, it's across the spectrum.
Exactly.
And as I said, it's not, you know, I would not say they alone caused
right. Oh, right,
it, but I think
exactly.
They're a key component. And since I started doing that research, and actually I wish that I had written a book, because since I started doing that and did this presentation supposedly, which did eventually lead to an article, other historians like Stanley Harold came out with a book called Border Wars. I think that's if I'm
right.
The name,
yeah.
That have essentially made the same argument that you have, you know, these debates over what to do about escaping slaves just kind of blow up and cause a huge problem for the country.
Were there other areas in terms of the Underground Railroad that you had got some more insight about?
I have not devoted all of my time to researching that.
Right.
There are some. It does generate exciting stories. I think the stories on the Underground Railroad are the kinds of things that can capture the imagination of children, a tourist, anybody.
Oh, right, exactly.
Because what people risked was amazing. And one of the key things, and I certainly wasn't the first one to talk about or write or argue this, is the Underground Railroad, we tend to think of it starting like the 1830s or so. Because that's really when white allies become involved, and it kind of gets the name, the Underground Railroad. It might have been earlier, 1820s.
Mm-hmm.
But black communities on both, and the North and South, and small black communities in places like Gettysburg and, you know, when Western PA and out in Ohio are key because they are always helping. And I'm not saying that every free black person
right.
was willing to risk to help escaping slaves, but there was an understanding there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the Underground Railroad is just a label we give
right.
to the slaves who wanted to escape and those who helped them. And so that's going on since before the Revolutionary War among black folks and a few white folks here and there. But it's when white allies start to get involved in the 1820s and 1830s and on is when it kind of gets a little bit, it's never a national, you know, it's never an organization with a president or anything like
right,
that. But
right.
it gets a little bit more coordinated and organized because they're able to communicate with one another. And some of it's just a matter of, you know, there's more newspapers and more ways to communicate and things like that.
In your research, did you find that where there were a preponderance of these stations?
Yeah.
I think of, you know, living in Gettysburg, one thinks of, one hears about the Underground Railroad, but what about other places?
Yeah, there's some people like Charles Blocks and others who have documented the kind of channels. And I mean, so it can happen anywhere, right? And,
right.
and some of the debates is, well, what defines an Underground Railroad station? So if you've got one small black farmer or a white store owner who helps an escaping slave one time and never does again, is that a station? You know,
exactly.
Or does it have to be more consistent? But there are places all along the borders between the North and South and further north. But there are some conduits that you can identify that tended to be more frequently used, like rivers that flow from north to south.
Okay.
But there is, Gettysburg was one of those places. There are some places out in western PA where you can identify that. Philadelphia is one because of railroads and rivers and roads. So any place where you have primary roads that are transgressing that north-south boundary or the Ohio River, where there are places that we know people cross, where there's a lot of traffic.
Right.
You know, you get that kind of thing. I mean, in a very similar way that migration works today across like the U.S.-Mexico border or places in Europe where you've got a lot of traffic, you know, it's harder to police.
So in some ways, this Underground Railroad continues.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not something that's 19th century, but it continues to this day.
Yeah.
And something that continues to be controversial.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. And that's actually one of the things that a lot of historians of slavery have been arguing for the last 20 years or so is that we need to understand these kind of things like slavery. Unfair labor, these kind of things as a continuum and not
right.
just, oh, well, this was this one period of time. I mean, it's important to understand that, yeah, there were differences
between
1840
and right,
now,
exactly.
But whether it's the migration of people from Central America to the United States looking for better opportunity or human trafficking from places in Europe or even the U.S., the U.S.-Canada border, things like that. You know, there are a lot of similarities.
Exactly. Where do you think your research, or what is your research interest now, or how is it changing or expanding?
Well, the way it's expanded most significantly in the last year is all the debates about the Confederate memorials. And so that's actually what I just went to a conference last week in Pittsburgh. Society of Civil War Historians present a paper about that, because after Charlottesville, I was asked by a former Gettysburg High School alum who graduated several years ago with my son, and he works for City Lab, which is a online magazine connected with The Atlantic.
Oh, okay.
Contacted me, said, oh, would you be interested in writing what they call a point of view essay about what it's like to live in Gettysburg with the Confederate memorials. So I wrote an essay, and that led to other things. And so what I've become interested in is the Confederate state memorials. So not the regimental markers, but the Confederate state memorials, both here at Gettysburg, but also not other national parks too.
What does that say to you, or what is that? What is that addressing or saying to you?
Well, it's you know, like we were talking about earlier, public history, right? So it's this intersection of academic and public history. And actually, some of this started because a friend of mine, David Seitz, who lives here in Gettysburg and teaches at Penn State Mount Alto, he's a communications professor. We were talking in 2015 after the murders in Charleston.
Right.
And there were some folks in our neighborhood just below the hill here in the seminary who had Confederate battle flags flying out of their front porches. And so my friend Dave was talking about how these Confederate symbols are a form of discourse, right? They're speaking to the public all the time, every day, whether people realize it or not. And so we started thinking about, okay, so what are the ways that we can speak back to those? And it's not about, we often get accused of saying we're trying to erase the past.
Right.
I would argue, no, actually what we want to do is we want to tell the whole story of the past, because it's the revisionisms of the Civil War that removed black people from the center of the story, that said, oh, the Civil War wasn't about slavery. The kind of revisionisms that would say, like, black folks didn't have anything to do with bringing the Civil War, which
right.
I would argue, well, escaped slaves and others, they certainly did. But some of the important story is we know that most of the Confederate state monuments at Gettysburg were put up during the Civil Rights era and shortly thereafter. So they were making statements about resisting integration and things like that.
I think that was enlightening when I heard you speak about that at the Rhodes Scholar presentation.
Yeah,
you know, I had not looked into the history of those state monuments.
Yeah, and I think it's people have asked me, do I think the Confederate state monument should be taken down? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be opposed to being taken down, but I'm actually not sure that would be the most useful solution, because it's an opportunity to teach all of these, you know, the million plus tourists that come to the battlefield every year, to teach them about what the Confederacy was actually all about, which its organizing principle was to protect slavery, and just as importantly, what the erection of the monuments and the use of Confederate battle flag and all those things in the 20th century, what that was all about, which was really about making a statement about white supremacy and a certain vision of America that was centered on whiteness. And I think educating visitors, you know, so I can imagine if you have some way of educating visitors, talking about when they go see the Virginia Monument,
right,
or the South Carolina Monument, and educating visitors about the battle itself, about the tactics. I mean, I think that's important. That's all good. But also
exactly.
Saying, and by the way, this monument, this is why it was put up. This is when it was put up. When South Carolina put up the monument in 1963, they had George Wallace, you know, segregationist number one, as the primary speaker, who's not even from South Carolina. You know, so let's get people to think about what that says and why those monuments are there, and what it says today, that they're still standing there without any of that information around them.
Exactly, you know? Exactly. So what you're saying is that there's not one story at Gettysburg. There are many stories.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
That
yeah,
need
so.
To be told
Absolutely.
And taught.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and one of the stories that I know a lot of the folks, the African-Americans who live in Gettysburg and have lived here their whole lives and their families go way back.
Right.
Their stories don't get told very effectively either.
Exactly.
And I think it's important that their stories get told, and also that they're the ones telling those stories. You know, we need a way to make that happen too.
Exactly. You know? Well, I can't believe our time has run out.
Yeah, and,
but I hope this won't be your last time on the Seminary Explorers.
I'll be happy to come back. But, yeah.
And but thank you for enlightening our listening audience
sure.
to the expanded story at Gettysburg.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the Seminary Explorers, this is Nelson Strobert. My guest today has been Dr. Scott Hancock, Associate Professor of History and Africana Studies at Gettysburg College. Have a good day.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explorers, a production of United Lutheran Seminary with campuses in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We invite you to visit our website at unitedlutheranseminary.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of United Lutheran Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.